Introduction 1. When I was 15 years old, I remember Iggy and the Stooges' song Search and Destroy reaching out from my speakers like my own personal anthem. It was a theme I would carry for decades as my own hell-bent mantra. That song might as well have been tattooed across my knuckles, because there could be no truer words for a young, alienated teenager. I'm a street-walking cheetah with a heart full of napalm. I'm a runaway son of a nuclear A-bomb. I'm a world's forgotten boy. Alice Cooper was another musical hero. Like Nostradamus, Alice must have seen the future when he sang, "Welcome to my nightmare," or at least my future. Welcome to my nightmare, welcome to my breakdown, I hope I didn't scare you. Yet Alice's nightmare was show business. This book is something else entirely. This is me welcoming you to a genuine living nightmare that I endured nearly 20 years ago. A nightmare that was so bad that it ended up killing me. But now I know it wasn't only the drugs, it was also my past unknowingly haunting me. And even a lethal combination of narcotics couldn't seem to kill the pain. I guess we could mix these two songs together. You'd have the theme song of my adolescence. On Christmas Day, 1986, I was a member of one of the biggest rock and roll bands in the world. I was also an alcoholic, a coke addict, a heroin addict, heading into a pill-popping downward spiral of depression. Welcome to my nightmare. Musically, I always thought Motley Crue was a nasty combination of rock, punk, glam, and pop sprinkled together with lots of sarcasm, anger, and humor, love, and hate, happiness, and sadness. Of course, depending on the recipe, there were always larger or smaller amounts of sex in there, too. I mean, what is rock and roll if it's not sexy? Sleazy, usually. Chauvinist, always. We crammed it all into a blender, and out came a very toxic cocktail. Palatable for the masses like Jim Jones' Kool-Aid. Sweet to the lips and deadly to ourselves, we were the drug scouts of America, and we were louder than hell. These diaries start on Christmas Day, 1986, but that day wasn't even that special. I was an addict well before then, and stayed one for a while afterwards. Perhaps that day just brought my condition home to me. There's something about spending Christmas alone, naked, sitting by a Christmas tree, gripping a shotgun that lets you know your life is spinning dangerously out of control. I'm a street-walking cheetah with a heart full of napalm. People over the years have tried to soften the blow by saying, maybe being in Motley Crue turned me into an addict. But I don't think it did. That stroke of genius was all my own work. Even as a kid, I was never inclined to dodge a bullet. I was always the first one to take it right between the eyes. I was stubborn, strong-willed, and always willing to put myself in harm's way for the betterment of chaos, confusion, and rebellion. All the traits that made me famous and later infamous. The ingredients for success and failure, all wrapped up in a nice package with the emotional stability of a Molotov cocktail. When I moved to LA in the late 70s and discovered cocaine, it only amplified these charming characteristics. I'm a runaway son of a nuclear A-bomb. But alcohol, acid, cocaine, they were just affairs. When I met heroin, it was true love. After we made it big, Motley Crue gave me more money than I knew what to do with. So naturally, I spent it on the only thing I wanted to do, drugs. Before the band, I lived only for the music. After it started, I lived only for the drugs. Okay, so maybe Motley Crue gave me the resources to be an addict, but you know what? If it hadn't, I'd have found some other way to do it. I guess we all have to live out our destiny, even those of us who have to choose the worst one imaginable. So why did I take this strange, dark trip? Well, I have a little 1-2-3 theory on this. 1, my childhood was shitty. My dad left when I was 3 and never came back. 2, my mom, she tried to love me, but every time a new guy came on the scene, I'd be in the way and she'd shuffle me off to live with my grandparents. And 3, I was born an addict. It's no surprise that I grew up feeling angry, unloved, and somehow needed revenge. Revenge on who? On the world? On myself? Welcome to my breakdown. I was always driven, even when I didn't know where I was going. Way before I met Tommy Lee, Vince Neil, and Mick Mars, I knew I would be in Motley Crue. I knew how we would look, and what we would sound like, and how we would behave. Fucking badly, obviously. Motley Crue was always about music and girls, music and drugs, and music and violence. We wanted to be the biggest, the dirtiest, the loudest rock band on the planet. We knew we were on our way in 1983 when we helicoptered in to play in front of 350,000 metal fans at a festival in Los Angeles. Our only gripe was that we should have been headlining. It was only a matter of time. We were on the highway to hell and had every bad intention of destroying anything and everything in our path. You could find us by the trail of sex, drugs, and rock and roll we left behind us. The one who searches and destroys. But two major things happened to me in 1983. Shout at the Devil went platinum and moved Motley Crue even further up the ladder. And I crashed my Porsche drunk, dislocated my shoulder, and started smoking heroin to numb the pain. The problem was I carried on smoking and then started injecting long after the pain was gone. Fuck, there were clues I was becoming a junkie. You'd need to be pretty self-obsessed to miss them. But if I was one thing back then, it was self-obsessed. When Vince Neil went to jail for 20 days, I didn't visit or phone our singer once. It never even occurred to me. It would have been a waste of valuable drug time. By the end of the Theater of Pain tour in 1986, I was on my way to becoming a full-blown junkie. I had OD'd after a show in London, been left for dead in a garbage dumpster. I'd turned up strung out to be Tommy's best man at his wedding with syringes hidden in my cowboy boots, and I stayed home freebasing rather than attend my own grandmother's funeral, the woman who had loved me and who had raised me. And things, they were about to get worse. Much worse. Welcome to my breakdown. The strangest thing is that during the darkest, most lost time of my life, I kept diaries. At home, as I was cracking up or on tour, I scribbled down my thoughts in battered journals or on scraps of paper. Sometimes I wrote in them completely sober and sane. At other times, they were like the diary of a madman. I think that in my drug-addled comatose mind, I felt my diary was the only person who really understood me. Maybe my only friend, someone to confide in? They don't say it's lonely at the top for nothing. I'd forgotten these diaries existed, or maybe I was in denial about them until I pulled them out of a storage locker last year, buried under my musty tour programs, magazine covers, and multi-platinum awards. They were genuinely shocking for me to read, a window back into a dark time in my life that I'd left behind a long time ago, hopefully never to return. As I write this, Motley Crue is back and playing all around the world again. I fucking love it. In some ways, life in the crew is as insane as ever. The amps are still too loud, and so is our attitude. I still love playing rock and roll. In fact, I can safely say it gets me high. I feel privileged to still be around to do what I love so much, and the fact that we still do it on our own terms is extremely fucking gratifying for me. The difference is I no longer come off stage from that adrenaline rush and launch into a kamikaze narcotics campaign to get even higher. Now the music and the fans are enough, just like it should be. I'm the same person, but I'm also a different one. You see, there's Sicky, and then there's Nicky. Many are sober, in control, rather than out of control and crazed. Occasionally, it even occurs to me that I may be the kind of person that Sicky of 1986 would have hated. That's okay, because I don't think I'd like to know Sicky in 2006 either, so we're even. I was listening to Velvet Underground again today, and heroin sounds as good as ever, especially when Lou Reed sings about heroin being his death, his life, and his wife. Who would have thought when I was growing up in Idaho that one of the most inspirational songs of my life would also end up being my theme song? Now, I could burn these insane diaries or put them back where I found them. Nobody would ever be the wiser. So why have I decided to publish them and show the world just what a fucked up, strung out madman I was at the height of my success? Well, it's simple. If one person listens to this audiobook and doesn't have to go down the same road as me, it was worth sharing my personal hell with them. I'm also donating profits from this book to help runaway kids at a charity I set up called Running Wild in the Night through Covenant House. You can check it out online at covenanthouse.org. They say to keep what you have to give it away. I believe that. I also believe that you can be cool as fuck, not give a fuck, and fucking kick ass in life and not be fucked up. I'm still the first person to say fuck you, but I'm faster to say I love you. If life is what you make it, I've made mine great. It took a lot of hard work, and if you need to, you can do it too. Last but not least, the lines I wrote in Home Sweet Home in 1985 are as true today as they were back then. My heart's like an open book for the whole world to read. Welcome to my nightmare. Enjoy. Nikki Sixx, December 2006.